Will you take your Bible, please, and turn to John chapter 6 and verse 16. And we'll resume our verse-by-verse study of the Gospel of John. In our last study, we looked at the first part of this chapter, where we have the very familiar miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. 5,000 men and their families, perhaps 20,000 people, are miraculously fed by Jesus. And we saw a great many applications to that story, in addition to the fact that it's the story of a great miracle. We called it the parable of the missionary vision of Jesus. We saw Jesus strategically place his disciples between himself and the hungry multitude, and all the provision for the multitude passed from the hands of Jesus through the hands of the disciples into the hands of the hungry families. And we said this was a parable of how Jesus would like to strategically place his church between himself and a lost world, and he would like to pass all his provision for the hunger and thirst of this lost world to the multitudes of this world through the hands of the church, through the human agency of the church. This is such an important truth. We'll mention a few things about that before we continue our study. But right now, if you'll come to verse 16 in chapter 6, reading from the New International Version of the Scriptures, we find these words. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. Now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. Now here's a little story that follows the story of the feeding of the 5,000. Before we look at some applications to this story, let me say just a word or two more about this miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, and especially the application we made in our last study. Someone has said that if you're a leader or an executive, you should always know the answer to 5 questions. First question, what are you trying to do? Stories told of how General Patton in the American Army during World War II arrived at a station in North Africa before they were ready for him, and things were in disarray. It was not even daylight, and he tripped over a GI who was asleep on the floor, and he kicked him, and when the GI woke up and saw who was towering over him, he jumped to his feet and saluted and said, "I'm sorry, sir, I was just trying to get some sleep." General Patton said, "You're the only one around here who knows what he's trying to do." Those were not his exact words, but that was the essence of what they meant. What are you trying to do? It's so important to know what you're trying to do, especially as a follower of Christ, involved in the work of Christ, as a pastor, as an evangelist, as a leader in the church. It's so important that we know what we're trying to do. In my opinion, any time a leader in the work of Christ is asked that question, the answer should immediately be the Great Commission. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to obey the Great Commission and evangelize the whole world. Well, the second question every leader should be able to answer is this. What are your objectives? In the light of a clearly defined mission or purpose, what are your objectives? You might say your short-term goals, as interpreted by your long-term goal or your vision or your mission. And then the third question, what are your opportunities? Where are the opportunities for you to accomplish these objectives and fulfill your goal? Then the fourth question, what are your resources? And then the fifth question is the best one. What is your strategy or plan for applying your resources to your opportunities to accomplish your objectives and then fulfill your purpose or your mission? Well, nobody ever knew the answer to those 5 questions like Jesus did. He knew what he was trying to do. He was trying to reach the whole world. And in the light of that clearly defined mission or vision, he knew what his objectives were. He always had short-term objectives that were to be interpreted in light of his long-term vision or mission, which was to reach the world. His short-term objective, it seems, in the early part of the Gospels is to recruit disciples, to recruit apostles from among the disciples. When it says in verse 3 of John 6 that he went up and sat on a hill with his disciples, we pointed out that this was John's very brief version of something that Mark and Matthew expand upon, the first retreat of the Christian church, where Jesus recruited disciples and then commissioned 12 of his disciples to be apostles. Matthew gives us the most detail about it. We call it the Sermon on the Mount. But it was really a recruiting retreat that Jesus held at the beginning of his ministry. That was perhaps a short-term objective, that retreat, where he recruited the people who were going to be ultimately placed between him and the lost world, and they would be the human agency of his outreach or his mission to the whole world. And then, what were his opportunities? Well, I'm reminded of a farmer who said, "I don't go to work, I'm surrounded by it." Jesus was always surrounded by his opportunities. Those multitudes of people with all their problems, they were his opportunities. But when we looked at this story, the feeding of the 5,000, and called it a parable of the missionary vision or strategy of Jesus, what we really saw was the disciples, these apostles that were commissioned from among the disciples, they were the resources of Jesus. And he was constantly trying to apply the resources of the 12 to the opportunities, all the need, as represented by these needy multitudes, so that he could accomplish his objectives and fulfill his mission or his purpose. We see all that when he strategically placed the disciples between him and the hungry multitude and passed his provision for the hungry multitude to the multitude through the disciples. You see this pictured in the teaching of Jesus elsewhere. At the last Christian retreat, at the end of his ministry, he'll talk about the vine and the branches, and he will say to them, "It's as if I'm the vine, you're the branches, and my Father's the gardener, and when he finds a branch in me that's fruitful, he prunes it to make it more fruitful. But just as branches align themselves with a vine in such a way that they draw from the vine the life-giving principle so that fruit can grow out at the end of the branches, you must be aligned with me, in union with me, in fellowship with me, so that you can draw from me the spiritual power to be fruitful." Now, isn't that beautiful metaphor in John 15? Notice the fruit doesn't grow on the vine. According to that beautiful illustration, Jesus is a vine looking for branches. Now, if the branch wants to see fruit, it has to abide in the vine or be in union with the vine. But if the vine wants to see fruit, it's got to have branches. That pictures for us something that, frankly, just overwhelms me. If I had been the Lord, I wouldn't have done it this way. It seems as if that illustration, the vine, the branches, and the fruit, is saying to you and me, without me, you can do nothing, but without you, I will do nothing. God could have produced fruit in this world any way he wanted to. He seems to have chosen to produce fruit through human agency. And without human agents, he has limited himself. He won't do anything. Jesus could have caused manna to fall from the sky. Back in the book of Numbers, that happened. But he doesn't. He uses a little boy's lunch, and he passes that little boy's lunch from his hands through the hands of the disciples into the hands of the hungry people. That's a great parable of the missionary strategy of Jesus. And that, I hope, speaks to all of us. Jesus is a vine looking for branches today. Are you willing to be one of those branches? To me, that's the big application to this very familiar miracle story with which the sixth chapter of the Gospel of John opens. I heard a story about a cathedral that was bombed during World War II, And it was so destroyed that it was just almost totally lost. But after the war, this was in Italy, the people restored the cathedral. And in the front part of the cathedral, there was a statue of Jesus, which they also restored. But they couldn't find enough pieces of the hands to restore the hands. And so rather than have a sculptor come in and make new hands, since it had been a masterpiece, they left the hands off. But underneath the statue, they put this brass plaque which said, "He has no hands but our hands." That's a very eloquent illustration of what I think is illustrated for us in the story of the feeding of the 5,000, in addition to the fact that it is the story of a very great miracle. Now, as we see today, that story is followed by this story about Jesus walking on the water. There are two stories in the Gospels that are very much like this. One story is where they decide to cross the Sea of Galilee. Jesus says, "Let's go over to the other side," and he goes with them, and he's asleep in the rear part of the boat with his head on a cushion, and this storm comes up very suddenly, just as they do over there on the Sea of Galilee. And they come and wake him. They're taking water. The storm is that ferocious. And they wake him with the words, "Don't you even care that we're all going to drown?" Well, he gets up and stills the storm. He turns the great storm to a great calm, it says. And then he asks them a great question. "Where was your faith? Why were you so afraid?" The Bible puts it this way, "Do you not even yet believe in me?" That story has such a beautiful application. So many times storms come up in our life and we think it's all over and we are panicked, and he stills the storm. He can turn the great storms of our life into, you know, great calms. But when he turns a great storm into a great calm, very often he asks us that question, what about your faith? In the midst of the storm, can you trust me? Do you believe me? Well, this story is similar to that. But it's not the same incident, of course. After the feeding of the 5,000, they come and they say they're going to make him a king, and he withdraws from that and goes up on the mountain again by himself alone, and he must stay up there on the mountain till the middle of the night praying. Now, we don't know what he prayed about, but I think we can assume he prayed about what he was trying to do, and he prayed about a lost world as represented by that multitude. And he probably prayed about the hunger and the thirst and the solution to the hunger and the thirst. And it could be, we're just speculating, I know, but it could be, in the middle of the night he realized that his solution to that lost world was out there in the middle of the Sea of Galilee in the midst of a storm. And he decided he better get back to his training of the sent ones, the apostles. And so he goes to them in the middle of the night, and they see him walking on the water in the middle of the night. And these men were no strangers to the waters or to storms. But the other Gospels tell us that they shrieked when they saw him walking on the water. The New International, from which I read in this study, said that they were terrified. At any rate, they realize that it's he, that it's the Lord, and he assures them, "Don't be afraid, it is I." And they take him into the little boat with them, and then immediately they are at their destination, which was Capernaum. I like to think of the words of an Episcopal rector in Pittsburgh years ago named Samuel Shoemaker. He said, "Fellowship is two fellows in the same ship." The idea of somebody being in the ship with you, of you being in the ship with them, that's a good paraphrase of the concept of fellowship. This word koinonia in the original language. Now think about two fellows in the same ship, and think about what it means to have somebody in the ship with you, or for you to get in the ship with somebody else. When you tell somebody you're in the ship with them, they might very well ask you, "Well, what are you doing in my ship? Are you just taking up room? Are you rocking the boat? Or are you going to grab an oar and row?" Well, when we're in fellowship with each other, when we get into each other's lives or ships, so to speak, we should always get in the ship with somebody else because we intend to grab an oar and row and be part of the solution and not part of the problem. But imagine in the context of that paraphrase of fellowship, what it could mean to have Jesus Christ in the ship with you. Should that make a difference? Well, it certainly should. And when they had Jesus in the ship with them, in both of these stories about storms coming up in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, there's no question about the fact that having Jesus in the ship could always turn a great storm into a great calm and focus the great question, what about your faith? This particular story is the one that Matthew reports to us in Matthew 14, and that's when he says, and Mark agrees with him, that's when Peter climbed over the side of the boat and walked on the water to Jesus. John leaves out that detail. But now, having told us that beautiful story, John goes on, and I'm reading now at verse 22 of John chapter 6. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. And once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. When they found him on the other side of the lake, they asked him, "Rabbi, when did you get here?" Jesus answered, "I tell you the truth. You are looking for me not because you saw miraculous signs, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. Do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. On him God the Father has placed his seal of approval." Then they asked him, "What must we do to do the work God requires?" Jesus answered, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent." So they asked him, "What miraculous sign then will you give that we may see it and believe you? What work will you do?" This begins the most difficult discourse of Jesus. It's called the Bread of Life Discourse. And like the Upper Room Discourse and the Mount Olivet Discourse, when you get into the study of the discourse, it isn't really a discourse in the conventional sense of the word as much as it's a dialogue. In the Upper Room, Jesus had dialogue with the apostles. When the Mount Olivet Discourse was given, it was given in response to the questions the apostles asked. When will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? In response to those questions, he gave those beautiful chapters, Matthew 24 and 25. And that's the case here. It's a dialogue, but the dialogue ends up becoming what we call the Bread of Life Discourse. It centers around the fact that he's the Bread of Life. But notice the Bread of Life Discourse doesn't start with the subject or the theme of bread. The theme at the beginning of the dialogue, which leads to the discourse, is work. Jesus rebukes these people because of their motivation for following him. They saw the signs, they saw the miracles, and it says early in chapter 6 that that's why they're there. And now that they've seen the feeding of the 5,000 hungry families, they've seen more signs, and that seems to be more reason why they're there. But Jesus rebukes them for having the wrong motivation for being there, following him. And he says, not only is their motivation wrong in that they have come because they've seen the signs, and their concept of faith is seeing is believing. Jesus is always trying to get across the point, no, believing leads to seeing. But he also says, you're here because I filled your bellies. You're here because you ate your fill of the fish and the bread. And then he brings up the subject of work. He says, you're working for the wrong things. You're not involved in the work that really matters. And they come back with the question, well, what is the work of God? And then they ask another question. They seem to say to him, well, if you're the one that's involved in meaningful work, then what do you do all day? What work do you do? I wonder, this raises a question for all of us by application. Are you involved in meaningful work? I think if we really believe in the two greatest experiences that a human being can experience, the way we saw them profiled in John chapter 4, the new birth, and then becoming the human agent, the branch plugged into the vine, through which other people come into the experience of the new birth, when that drink of living water becomes in us a spring of water from which other people come and drink and, you know, quench their deep thirst. Jesus, in these figures of speech, is profiling for us The two greatest experiences in the world, being born again, our drink of living water, and being the human instrument or agent through which other people are born again, that drink becoming a spring from which other people come and drink. If you really believe in the new birth, and if you believe that God uses human beings to accomplish the new birth in other human beings, then you ought to be involved in meaningful work. That work of being strategically placed between the Christ who really is and what he's trying to do, reach a lost world. To be placed strategically between him and that lost world and be the human agent through which his work is done. That's just one of the greatest things for any human being. And it seems to me that if we really do believe in the right way with the right motivation about that first great Christian experience, the new birth, we certainly ought to believe in meaningful work, being involved in the work of Christ. I live in a college town, and a student told me years ago that he had done a lot of research on a man named Sir Leonard Wolfe, who was the husband of Virginia Woolf and a British liberal statesman. As he researched this man's life, he found this rather cynical epitaph that the man wrote in his diary. "Looking back at the age of 88, over the 57 years of my political life in England, knowing what I deem best of results and meditating on the history of Britain and the world since 1914, I see clearly now that I achieved practically nothing. The world today and the history of the human anthill during the last 57 years would be exactly the same as it is if I had played ping pong instead of sitting on committees and writing books and memoranda. I have therefore to make the rather ignominious confession to myself and to anyone who may read this, that I must have in a long life ground through between 150 and 200,000 hours of perfectly meaningless work." What an epitaph for a human life, especially a long life of 88 years. Frankly, I don't believe that any believer, true believer in Christ, who has himself or herself experienced a new birth, who realizes that they are to be the human agency of the new birth to this lost world, should ever feel that they're involved in meaningless work. And certainly, they should never come to the end of a life of 88 years and say, "I achieved nothing. I might as well have played ping pong instead of doing what I've done with my life. I have ground through 200,000 hours of perfectly meaningless work." I believe in this sixth chapter of John, as we get into the most difficult discourse of Jesus, the Bread of Life discourse, the first subject that confronts us is work. And the challenge is, are we involved in the meaningful work of being strategically placed between Jesus and a lost world and being the human agents, being the branches through whom the life of Christ is being passed to a world that doesn't have the quality of life he wants them to have? Are we involved in that? To me, that's a great challenge that we face as we begin the Bread of Life discourse. Well, again, in this much of the sixth chapter of John, who is Jesus? Well, Jesus is not only the bread of heaven, the bread of life. He's not only the one who can feed the deep hunger of human beings, but he is the one who shows us what meaningful work is. He shows us what the work of God is. And think of all the purpose and meaning that can bring into our life if we understand that. What is faith? Well, I believe here, as we get into the Bread of Life discourse, faith is believing that the work of being the human agents of Christ to a lost world is meaningful work. And what is life? Well, life is the fulfillment that comes from knowing that our work is not meaningless, that we have meaningful work. Have you ever thanked God when you wake up in the morning for meaningful work, for having a reason for waking up in the morning, knowing that you're part of what God is doing in this world?